This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. This is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. In the news this week, John Kasich says he has a plan to improve the relationship between police and members of the minority community. The U.S. Supreme Court now holds the fate of Ohio's ban on same-sex marriages in its hands. And John Kasich takes another baby step, perhaps, in his long and torturous journey towards possibly running for president. He appeared on Fox News Sunday yesterday and was asked by Chris Wallace to put odds on his chances of running for president.
Look, I thought the Spurs would beat the Clippers, and I picked the wrong horse in the Kentucky Derby. I don't do odds. I find out they never really work out very well, Cliff, Chris, but we'll let you know as soon as we can. It looks pretty good.
Well, you sound like a candidate, and you sound like a very interesting candidate.
I'm not sure I want to sound like a candidate. I just want to sound like an American who's trying to make this country a heck of a lot stronger.
Two things indicate he's running for president there. One, he combed his hair. And two, he says, I'm not a politician.
Right.
Those are two indications that he's running for president. Our reporters joining us today, Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch, and Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Laura Bischoff, you've been on the road with Governor Kasich. Are we getting closer to him saying, okay, I'm running?
I think so. I think he's, he formed that 527, was it last week? That'll help help him raise money and be a mechanism for funding his trips to all these different states. I think that, he's getting a lot more national attention, a lot of earned media, big profiles in newspapers and magazines and blog sites. There was a piece in The Atlantic that came out last week that was extensive. And I think even though it kind of painted a mixed portrait of him, I think on balance it came off looking pretty good for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they captured John Kasich as his true self. He can kind of be abrasive,
yeah,
and put people off. And even Rob Nichols, his press secretary, sent the thesaurus entry for the word prickly to the reporter so that they had plenty of options there.
Used it, too. She definitely went all out on every single adjective.
Right. Yeah. But at the same time, I thought that the article talked about how he's got national experience. He's got executive experience, that it's sort of a now or never moment for him. He's 62. Or
sounds
going on 62.
Right. Yeah.
He's got a birthday in May sometime. So I think that that kind of attention, it will help him, because right now he's pulling pretty low in the name recognition.
Yeah,
name recognition.
He's not known.
The political class knows about him. I think maybe Fox
right.
News viewers on Sunday morning may know him, but do enough voters in New Hampshire?
No.
In Iowa, and do enough donors. That's the key. Do enough Republican donors know
no.
enough about him?
No. I can only say no to that. He's just not well known. But he's seriously, as Laura pointed out in several things she said, he is clearly seriously considering this. He's clearly trying to see how far this might lead. And who knows how far it may lead? You don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people a lot of Republicans interested in the primary. There's no clear front runner. I mean, it doesn't seem to me. So why not John Kasich? I think that's kind of his attitude going forward. Why not John Kasich? He looked around at the field and thought, why not me? What are my credentials? How are they any different than anybody else that's out here? And I think he's seriously testing to see how far he can go. How far that is, we don't know yet. But I think he's willing to go as far as it'll take him.
Andy Chow, I think everyone has always said just like it was 16 years ago when he was considering running. It was at the time George W. Bush that took all the air out of the room and took all the money out of the room as far as Republican candidates go. Jeb Bush has not had that same effect, at least not yet. And I think John Kasich sees that. And says that he admitted yesterday he can't compete with Jeb Bush on fundraising, but he sees that he could at least be competitive.
I think the governor is looking at the field and seeing that there's definitely a place at the table for him if he were to run. Looking at the possible people who could run, other than I think Scott Walker, he would be the only active executive in the field. So he's the only one who can say, listen, I'm doing this right now in this climate. I'm fixing the economy in this way. Jeb Bush can't really say that. He hasn't been governor since 2007. And so I think there's definitely a place where he can say, this is me, this is who I am, and this is what I can do that nobody else can do. Now, back to the Atlantic article, I thought it was pretty interesting because
the title of the article was The Unpleasant Charisma of John Kasich, which was a wonderful play on words. The charisma, using a positive term, but you know, he can be unpleasant at times, according to the article.
And it painted a very accurate picture of who he is, all the good things about him, all things that could be negatives about him. But what it does is it actually creates a personality where some of these other people, we don't really know who they are. And he can actually build upon that and say, this is my character, this is my personality. Like it or not, it's out there. And again, it goes back to name recognition, which is what he needs the most.
I just want to add to that. He also can kind of play on this like no nonsense, get things done. This isn't a governor, and I've said this before probably on this show, who creates task forces. This isn't a governor who does study groups. This is a governor who acts and acts quickly. And I think, you know, he'll be able to show some examples of that may be very appealing to someone, but he's going to have to cut through some voters.
We'll get to those task force things in a moment. But first, New Hampshire is a key. I mean, I don't think John Kasich is going to win Iowa. I think he's too moderate to win the Iowa caucuses. And he hasn't really been to Iowa that much, if at all. But New Hampshire, John McCain, the Straight Talk Express, beat was competitive with George W. Bush in New Hampshire. Is John Kasich following that John McCain playbook in New Hampshire, do you think, Laura?
It's unclear to me, but he has been there, I think.
He's going there again this week.
At least three times.
Yeah. So obviously he's not just going there for the ham and eggs breakfast that they serve at the political conference or whatever. I think he's definitely making a push there. The last I saw, he was polling very low.
Two or 3%.
Yeah, like hardly anything.
Yeah.
There's still time, and now that he's got more, he's got this 527. Maybe he'll be making more trips there. I think one of his big backers is John Sununu from New Hampshire, and we'll see what kind of pull he has still in that state to help bring along Kasich.
And a lot of these possible contenders are polling low in these areas, and a lot of voters say, "Well, I can't get behind somebody until they actually enter the race, until they say that they're really serious about it." So. At some point, he might have to really just jump in and say, this is me. I'm running for president. And that might see a spike in numbers we don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see. Speaking of task forces and study groups, I know Kathy mentioned that the governor doesn't like to – he's not a task force governor. But he did form by executive
order. You're already proving me wrong.
he did form this police standards board that will develop over the next months, I guess, some standards that police agencies throughout the state will have to follow. Of course, this is in response to the Tamir Rice shooting in Cleveland, the issues in Ferguson, Missouri, and more recently in Baltimore, Maryland, trying to bridge the divide between African-American communities primarily and the police force. The governor was very forceful in his press conference, sitting alongside Nina Turner, and saying we have to do something, but it's still – the details are still to be worked out. Do we expect big changes in how police departments are run because of this task force?
I don't think it'll be big, at least at first. I think they're going to have to do a lot of little provisions first to start chipping away at it to make it kind of dip their toe in the water to figure out what they need to do first and then maybe make some bigger changes later down the road.
What I think is interesting is at the same time that John Kasich formed this task force, Mike DeWine formed one to look at law enforcement training. And the DeWine task force came out like maybe a week before the Kasich one and said that they thought that that Ohio has 62, I think, open academies where you can just go to school, pay tuition, and get trained as a police officer. And if you pass the state exam, go get hired by a department. And some of those academies have passing rates in the 30s, like 30% or so. And so they just think that there needs to be more oversight by the Ohio Police Officers Training Academy, which is run by the AG's office, more oversight of those training academies. And secondly, they said that they need to have more training. Right now it's like 605 hours to become a police officer. They need more training, and more training in community relations, more training in bias, inherent biases that everybody has to kind of recognize and understand those. And then also you know, the police officers only have to do 4 hours of annual ongoing training. And DeWine's commission says that they'd like to see that increase to 40 hours per year.
Yeah.
And a lot of it would focus on community relations and responding to mental health issues, things where a lot of, you know, a really volatile situation can turn deadly really quickly. And if you have the right training, maybe you can diffuse it.
Yeah, the governor says this new – the governor's plan calls for new standards in recruiting and hiring of police officers, getting to the diversity issues. He also calls for statewide standards on the use of deadly force. And most big cities now have standards on the use of deadly force.
Well, the police groups, like the unions and everything, they've been saying, yeah, the bigger cities, they do have some type of standard. It's these local communities when you get down to smaller towns and everything that don't really have such standards. And so they're saying that if the state creates such standards, that it'd help everybody.
But how many police-involved shootings are in the small communities?
I was going to say, it doesn't seem like they're ever in the small communities.
I mean, once in a while.
Well, you know, what's interesting is
that can't hurt to have the standards.
Yeah.
But
last August, the John Crawford shooting at the Walmart in Beaver Creek.
Yep.
Beaver Creek is a fairly small suburban
department.
And this officer who was involved, who was responsible for the shooting, he had been responsible for another deadly shooting in his career, and he hadn't been on the force for very long.
Often you raise a really good point, Laura. Often when you hear about these incidents, it involves someone, an officer who's had something happen in the past. It's almost like, you know, other people that get in trouble. It's not the first time. It does make you wonder if that's something they need to look at more closely, what to do in the wake of these incidents. You know, to these officers that are involved, because they do seem it's often where it happens, something happens again, or they have some kind of record.
And that's where one of the things that the governor also wants to look at with this board is the accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Andy, the big question always is, should prosecutors, county prosecutors who work so closely with police on a day-to-day basis, should they be the ones through a grand jury process to decide if a police officer should be charged criminally for a police-involved shooting?
And that's a tough decision, and I think that might have to work on a – well, I don't know if it's going to have to work on a case-by-case basis or not. But if you look at the situation in Ferguson, they did not appoint a special prosecutor, and they obviously did not come out down with any indictments. But then if you look at the case in Baltimore, it is that prosecutor who's really pushing for murder charges against the police officers there. And the police officers have been actually calling for a special prosecutor in this case. So, you know, it all depends sometimes.
Yeah. I know there was one suggestion, have a judge oversee the prosecution. It gives some independence to the proceedings.
Well, it would help the image. I mean, it's an image. Whether it's right, whether it happens or not, there is the impression amongst the public that it's not a good thing to have the prosecutor involved in the case. But
There's always going to be a conflict of interest one way or the other, whether it is to work to the benefit of the police officers or work to the benefit of the other side. So, yeah, getting a special prosecutor would eliminate that image problem.
Or a judge. That's not a bad idea either.
I think it's going to be interesting if more departments also start to use body cameras. This raises a huge issue about how they're going to archive the data collected every day from hundreds of officers, whether or not that information would be public record, when it would be released, under what conditions,
et cetera. Yeah, it's a thorny issue. I mean, you want to have witnesses come up to police, feel free to come up to police, and if their picture's going to be on the news that night, they might be less willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that although we are talking about – the question was asked, well, are there a lot of big police-involved shootings in smaller communities? It's not just police shootings that this committee is going to try to tackle. It's the general relationship between police forces and the community, how police officers treat members of the community, whether they're white, they're black, they're Asian, Latino. Are they being treated fairly, and how can we fix this issue?
Okay. When we come back, we'll take a look at what happens now that the Supreme Court has heard arguments in the same-sex case involving Ohio and some other states when our Reporters' Roundtable continues here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Our guests, Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio, and Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. We look back at what made news last week and look ahead at what might make news this week. We urge you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 292-8513. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. About 6 days ago, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments involving same-sex marriage bans in Ohio and three other states. The justices will now decide whether to uphold those bans or whether to allow same-sex marriage across the country. And they will also decide if states like Ohio that have bans are forced to recognize gay marriages legally performed in other states. So really, it's just a waiting game now. All the arguments have been heard. What are the two sides doing, Andy, right now as they wait? Do they have any – are they making contingency plans?
I think they're just waiting right now, trying to make sure you know, the big issue is that there's been a ballot initiative here that almost made it to the ballot, and now they've just decided, let's wait to see what the Supreme Court says. So I think their next step might be to get the ballot initiative rolling again if the Supreme Court decides against what they want. And it is also interesting to think about, I believe – they could always have sort of a partial decision, kind of like the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, where they decide part of it but not all of it and punt the rest of the stuff back to the state. And like you said, the second part, which is the amendment here in Ohio, that might not be resolved. So there's all sorts of decisions that could come out of this.
Anthony Kennedy seems to be the swing vote. There's the four conservatives and four liberals, and he's right in the middle. And he asked the question, you know, we've been defining marriage as a man and between a man and a woman for thousands of years. Should the Supreme Court change that now? Of course, then later on he talked about the dignity of marriage and how same-sex couples just want to have the same dignity as other couples. Any hints as to how can you read into it?
You shouldn't. Really.
I know we really shouldn't.
You shouldn't, because a lot of times the justices ask questions to get the argument for it or against it so that they can use that in their decisions later. So whether he was looking for some kind of argument on an opposing side or a side he agreed with is hard to say. So most people that watch the court closely, much more closer than I, advise that you shouldn't read too much into these. But definitely he is the swing vote. And there were things that he said that both sides can take comfort in, but who he was really speaking to, we won't know till the decision comes out.
Yeah, I mean, the justices are like reporters in a way. They're posing questions to challenge the attorneys for each side.
Right, and Kathy's right. Some of them sometimes it might sound like they're in favor of one side, but really they're playing devil's advocate to try to draw out the details and get down to the nitty gritty of the argument.
So they can defend their position later.
Mm-hmm. This whole thing of a divided decision where they would say, okay, the states should decide whether or not to ban same-sex marriage, but okay, but if the states should recognize marriages from other states, Laura, that would cause some logistical problems here in Ohio. I mean, right now, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Indiana all have legal same-sex marriage. I assume the Ohio couples would just go to the nearest state, get married, and come on back.
Go to Indianapolis and get married and then come back. They could, and then they could get full recognition in Ohio, if that's how the decision came across. But I think also there's a number of activists in the gay and lesbian community that really want to have just full recognition and the ability to get married in their home state. And even if it were legal in other nearby states and recognized in Ohio, I think that there still would be a push to overturn the gay marriage ban, which I think went on the ballot in
04 is what I think. Yeah,
right. So I think that if there was a partial decision and Ohio didn't get full legal gay marriage, then there would be a push to go to the ballot.
And you know, again, I'm not a lawyer or even a close court watcher, as I revealed earlier. But it seems to me that if they had a decision like that, you would then have people living in the state of Ohio, for instance, with different rights. Couples that got married outside the state versus couples, same-sex couples that are just living in Ohio and aren't married. It seems to me that would almost open a bigger can of worms in terms of controversy and, you know, treating people different.
Oh, and logistically and administratively, they would bring paperwork and marriage licenses from other states, and they would have to file with this state to get certain benefits and everything. That right. It would cause a big headache.
Mm-hmm. Most people before the arguments took place predicted that the Supreme Court would nullify the bans and that same-sex marriage would be legal across the state, which led to opponents of gay marriage to push these so-called religious freedom bills. And mm-hmm. like we saw the controversy in Indiana where trying to protect, they say, folks from serving or catering or doing business with or participating in a gay marriage, a gay wedding, because of their religious beliefs. Any of that happening here in Ohio, Andy?
Well, I believe there is a bill that would basically double down on rights that are already established, meaning that it would allow a religious leader to refuse to marry a same-sex couple. But that's something that already exists. I think the interesting part of that bill might be, well, could a justice of the peace be then able to refuse to marry a same-sex couple if same-sex marriage were then legal in Ohio?
Or a mayor or a city official
right.
who and is for a civil marriage, purely civil marriage.
Correct, yeah, non-religious for civil marriage. Mm-hmm. And but so that'll be the interesting part of that debate.
I'm wondering, though, a mayor or a justice of the peace, can he or she now refuse to marry a couple, like thinking you're too young or mm-hmm. you haven't dated long enough or
you're related.
Yeah.
If they're related, it's illegal. But yeah. I mean, can they exercise discretion right now?
Right.
You know, if you want to get married in the Catholic Church, you know, you have to meet their criteria and mm-hmm. have to be, you know, a member of the church and both of you Catholic and have had other rites of the church. And so there's already that, like Andy said, it's already established that you know, religious institutions do not have to marry a couple if they don't.
That seems to be a kind of a red herring argument.
It does.
That if the Supreme Court were to allow gay marriage, that religious leaders would be forced to marry gay couples against their religious beliefs.
It does. And what couple wants to be married by someone who doesn't support their you know, marriage? I just think it's kind of a bogus argument and just kind of meant to rile people up a little bit. And the bottom line is there's going to be plenty of people in Ohio that are going to want to marry gay couples mm-hmm. And celebrate those unions. So I just don't see the issue. And those that don't.
And keep in mind, every edition of the ballot initiative that we've seen that could possibly go on the ballot has always had language that said it still allows religious leaders to be able to refuse to marry a couple if it's against their beliefs.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Catholic Church, Laura. I mean, the Catholic Church, they refuse to marry divorced people in the church.
Right.
I mean, unless there's been an annulment, but I mean, that's clearly legal from a civil marriage
there's
standpoint.
A lot of churches that require you to go through premarital counseling mm-hmm. In order for you to get married in that church. So
I raise the question, you know, if say the Supreme Court does uphold the ban and it likely will get on the ballot in 2016, does that – I think that hurts whoever the Republican nominee for president is if there is a gay marriage ban ballot on the gay marriage question on the ballot in 2016. If you remember in 2004, a lot of people credit the gay marriage ban for helping George W. Bush win Ohio. I almost think it has the opposite effect in 2016.
I agree.
I tend to agree yeah. with you on that. I think you're right. I think that the society's views on gay marriage have changed over the last decade. And I think that that if you are running for president and you're on the record as against gay marriage – I think – and then there's an actual issue. I think it's really going to hurt you.
Especially in a state like Ohio mm-hmm. where there's a lot of support, as Laura pointed out.
If the Democratic nominee isn't getting Democratic voters excited enough to come out to the ballot, that issue certainly will be.
But, you know, Karl Rove and George W. Bush, they really did mobilize hardcore conservative voters, particularly in southwest Ohio, to come out against the ban and thus vote for George W. Bush. Could that not happen again, or is the even down in the more conservative parts of Ohio has the support for gay marriage or the opposition to gay marriage hasn't waned?
I think it could help drive opponents of gay marriage, clearly, but it's also going to drive proponents of gay marriage. And I think when you look at the two, I think proponents win on this one. I think that there's more support, and I think that there's more motivation on that side to get out.
And I think you're right. There's not enough extreme hostility towards the issue as there used to be as well. So maybe they're not going to get driven out to go vote against it, but maybe there's not that this extreme emotion to vote against it as there was 10 years ago.
In 2004, if you recall, it was right after Massachusetts legalized it. There was a huge upswell of folks saying, don't let it happen here, you among know, conservatives, don't let it happen
I
here.
I wish we
like
had
that.
Poll numbers on the top. I can't think of them, but there's been such a seismic shift on this issue in public opinion in the last several years.
It's gone from 60-40 opposing gay marriage to basically 60-40. Supporting gay marriage in the national polls.
And it's just a matter of when, not if. It really is just a matter of when in Ohio.
And it's especially if you look at the young Republican people who are polled, they are definitely on the side of same-sex marriage. And so, if you know, more and more Republicans, especially at a younger age.
This is our weekly Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch is with us, as is Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News. Speaking of voting, Groundhog Day in Ohio, there's another bill requiring a photo ID to cast a ballot proposed by conservative Republicans in the House, even though the number of non-U.S. citizens voting in 2014 was 22,
right.
I believe. 22,
right.
Almost two dozen. Out of the millions of voters cast. And the ironic thing is, Laura, that all of those folks had a photo ID to vote.
Right. And well, what's interesting is the proponents of this bill would say that there were, 77 elections in the last whatever number of years that were decided by one vote. So, you know, every vote matters, and they don't want the 22 or whatever number it was of people who don't have a legal right to vote polluting and corrupting the process. However, this would create you know, some bureaucratic logistical questions and challenges for people. Now, I think the bill sponsor says that if you're below 100% of the federal poverty level, that you'll be issued a state ID for free. But if you're below the poverty level, there's a good chance that you don't have reliable transportation to get to the BMV. You don't have all the paperwork together to present to the BMV to get your free state ID. And so it could be seen as disenfranchising large swaths of voters. And I would predict that it will bring a big constitutional challenge from the voting rights activists if it were to pass.
And Mike, you're right. Out of the 22 people, the non-U.S. citizens who voted, all of them had an ID. So this would not solve that problem at all. And even the top elections official in the state, Secretary of State John Husted, has said this wouldn't fix it. And he's been pushing for a different measure, which is online voter registration. He says that will create a better database. It'll give people a better look at who is actually allowed to vote in Ohio. And so if you don't even have Secretary of State Husted, who is not only the top elections official but a Republican, and if he's not for this issue, I don't think this is going to go anywhere.
Would online voter registration, would that solve the problem? It seems like that would also hurt lower-income folks who don't have easy access to a computer. You could argue that that's not a uniform way to get people registered to vote.
As an option, though, I think it's kind of time, isn't it? I mean, you still have to give people other options of registering to vote, but online voter registration seems, especially when you think of how many people register to vote when they turn 18, younger people, these are the people that would, you know, embrace online registration.
And you could say, I mean, you have voter registration drives. Both parties have them. They could go door to door with a tablet connected to the internet, and they could.
Libraries could hold events. Yeah, there are all sorts of ways to get people access to computer if it's not only if it's just for 10 minutes even. So
292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation, 292-8513, or you could call, email us at allsides@wosu.org. Real quickly, the U.S. Senate race is kind of plugging along. There's still two Democrats running, Ted Strickland and P.G. Sittenfeld. To no one's surprise, Ted Strickland's fundraising has picked up. He's basically now tied with P.G. Sittenfeld. They both have about $700,000. Sittenfeld's donations have slowed down. Some say it's because Strickland has entered the race. Sittenfeld's spokesman says it's because, look, you know, whenever you announce, you get a bunch of cash right up front, and then you got to go out and work harder for it. Do we see P.G. Sittenfeld raising enough money to stay in this race through the primary?
Jessica Werman from the Dispatch had a really good analysis of that and showed that I think Strickland is outraising Sittenfeld like 3-1 now. Mm-hmm. So Sittenfeld had a good head start, and that helped him match or he exceeded Strickland initially. But I think that it is telling that I think that he's going to have a hard time staying in the race.
And don't forget that the Ohio Democratic Party has now endorsed Strickland, too. Mm-hmm. So that's another blow to his campaign.
Once that happened, it seemed to take a little bit of the wind out of his sails. But, you know, I don't know what the thinking is on how long he should stay in the race for no other reason than to kind of set him up as a formidable candidate in some future time. So, you know, maybe it's helpful for him to stick around for a while, especially you don't see them going at each other.
Yeah. But the way the Democratic Party is working right now, if he stays in this race, I wonder if they're even going to give him a chance to run for something else. Because, I mean, they've been so against his campaign from the get-go to try to, like you said, take the wind out of his sails and endorse him so early.
I mean, the most expensive thing about running for office is the TV money. If he would have just used that $700,000 to, you know, travel the state and shake hands and go to chicken dinners and – I mean, that's a good use of his resources to build a name and run a positive campaign. Maybe, I don't know.
You know, it's interesting. He's very bright and energetic, and he was the top vote getter in the Cincinnati City Council race, and it's of course one of the big cities in Ohio. So he's got a good base. And I think Kathy's right. Like, how can they kind of build him as a future candidate for one of the statewide races? It's a delicate balance because he can't go against Strickland for too much longer and still hope to have the Democratic Party backing him for some other future race.
Right.
Yeah. He keeps saying it's time for new leadership and things like that, which the Democrats don't want to hear because that –
Because they want to hear it's time for old leadership.
Yeah, well, Strickland's 73 years old. You know, if he attacks Rob Portman and keeps on that line, it might help him out in the long run. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the budget battles at the State House. The Kasich administration is going head to head with the Republican leadership in the Ohio House. When our reporters' roundtable continues here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It's our weekly reporters' roundtable, trying to look ahead to see what might make news this week. With me, Kathy Kandisky for the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News. Of course, it's the state budget now is in the hands of the Ohio Senate. The governor has presented his budget, which called for some tax cuts, but also some tax increases. The House didn't want a whole lot to do with the tax increases, so they included a tax cut, although smaller than the governor's plan, and now the Senate is basically here to break the tie. Is that what's going to happen?
The Senate's going to come in, and I think they're going to bring back a lot of what the governor wanted in the first place. And I think you're going to have to, because if the governor doesn't like the budget so much that he doesn't even sign it, I mean, that's going to be a big problem. And I think if you listen to the rhetoric from Speaker of House Cliff Rosenberger, He's used the word message a lot, and he's basically saying, we're trying to send a message that we want this. We're sending a message that we want this. So I think in the end, if the Senate comes back and even brings like even half of what the governor wanted, I think the House might comply in the end.
It's always a give and take. Mm-hmm. I think that when the House was finished with the budget and sent it over to the Senate's message was, oh, we don't like this. We're gonna redo a lot of it. And I think Andy's right. We'll probably see a lot of the governor's stuff reshaped and put back into the budget. But you know, it's a three-way operation because you get the House thoughts on it, the Senate, and the governor. And once it gets to the governor's desk, he can either veto the whole thing or line item veto. He gets an eraser, but not a pencil. So he can, you know, wipe out stuff that they put in, but he can't like add back his tax cuts.
He can't add in the cigarette tax. We can't add in a fracking tax.
But he can take some school funding away, which is a big thing that the House put back in, like $270 million in school funding that the governor didn't originally have.
Yeah. What's interesting this week is you saw, or last week I guess it was, that you saw Budget Director Tim Kaine come over to the Senate and be extremely, I thought, strong in his criticism of the House proposal, which they say they do that every time, but it sounded a lot harsher to me than it has in past budgets. So they're really pushing back on a lot of things, particularly the school funding changes that were made. They also would like to see more of those tax cuts put back in.
Isn't divided government great when you have two parties really balancing each other out in the Ohio State House? Oh, wait a minute.
Or in this case, all the same party.
So what's going on here? This is the type of battles you have in the U.S. Congress where you do have divided government.
Well, the other thing is I do think that Senate President Keith Faber is very close to John Kasich. He traveled to New Hampshire with him. And
that's right.
I think that Faber and Kasich probably see more eye to eye on various policies. So I think Kasich will win back some of the things that he wanted.
I think so too.
The education funding. I mean, I think Tim Kaine's some of his harshest comments were about that, saying that the House is just we have to fix this problem, and by just giving more money to every district, Kathy, is not the way to do it.
It's a philosophical thing. The governor wants to have a formula and follow the formula. And he doesn't like artificial manipulation of the formula, like guarantees that no district loses money. And Kaine pointed out last week, we have a district that's had declining enrollment for 20 years, but because of the guarantee, they're still getting the same amount of funding. Well, most people would think that's not a good idea. But unfortunately, when you get those printouts, what every district gets, and the lawmaker looks at the districts in his area and sees 10 of them are losing funds, they react, and that's what you're seeing. But the governor doesn't like the caps, and so the House has put back these manipulations to guarantee nobody gets a cut. The governor's budget would have cut about, I think it was just over half the school districts in the state, which probably was a big ask,
yeah,
a big lift for him to think that would get by as is. So,
Are the senators as prone or as apt to go along with the complaints from the district, or are they more immune to say, you know what, we do have to bite the bullet here and have less money for my district and my Senate district?
Their districts are bigger.
Yeah.
So maybe they're a little less sensitive to it, but, it seems they all react to the districts in their region.
And I think they might land somewhere in the middle between where the House is and where the governor is on this, because nobody's going to look good. Nobody in the Senate's going to look good if they now take out that $270 million altogether.
And when you look at the budget as a whole, how do you rationalize giving all these tax cuts and cutting funding to over half the school districts in the state, whether they have declining enrollment or what? That's kind of tough. I mean, that's kind of a tough ask. So somewhere in the middle, that's all. Well, that we can say with certainty, somewhere in the middle.
You know, earlier we talked about this Atlantic article where it talked about John Kasich shoot from the hip and kind of abrasive style that he can have. And they had a scene in that piece when dealing with the school districts and the funding and how Kasich asked to get the state superintendent on the phone to convince lawmakers to go along with these cuts, but it was after the budget had been presented. And the author speculates, had John Kasich and his administration laid the groundwork for this ahead of time, played some politics ahead of time, it might have gone a little easier. Andy, does his shoot from the hip style hurt him when he's governing, trying to convince members of his own party to go along with his ideas?
It's funny that you bring up that part of the article, because that's the only part of the article that I kind of disagreed with, because it kind of said, oh, John Kasich doesn't calculate any of his moves, because I think he's very calculated in a lot of the things that he does. So I think more of the case, maybe there was some miscommunication where he's like, hey, didn't we talk to this person a couple of weeks ago about this situation, and are they not making the calls that they need to make? So I think maybe there is something lost in translation with that article. But I do think the whole shoot from the hip strategy does rub leaders the wrong way. And it appears that he doesn't take what they think into consideration. And I think, you look at what the House has done. They wanted to establish their independence and say, this is what we think should be done. It's not the governor's budget. It's the state of Ohio's budget. And this is what we're going to make out of it. And it goes back to the whole message thing. They're sending a message. Maybe it's not going to be what their rendition looks like in the end. But I think they've accomplished what they wanted to, which was establish some sort of independence.
292-8513, if you'd like to get on law on board. We're probably going to stick with education and some of those issues in the last few minutes of the show. 292-8513 or allsides at WOSU.org. Kathy Kandisky, I think the last bit of PARC testing or whatever the standard Common Core related testing is now over. It's ending now in school districts around the state. But the future of these tests remains in doubt.
It does. And well, first we should probably talk back about the budget. The House budget defunded PARC and banned the state from paying PARC. So they've sent that message. They also
But that would cost a lot of federal money if that went through. So the chances
that would
of that
cost
happening.
A lot of federal money, but they stuck it in there anyway. Mm-hmm. And they also cut the Department of Education's school testing budget by like half or something, like a big chunk of the money. So this has got to get reconciled in the Senate or in conference committee or somewhere. But the bigger issue is there are very big concerns about testing in Ohio, student testing. Students are spending too much time testing, a lot of people feel. There's a lot of pushback on these new PARC exams. People, I think they think they're too hard. They think they take too much time. And I think there's people that don't like the fact that Ohio is part of a consortium of states that put together tests that are being used in all the states that are part of PARC. The rationale is they match up with the new Common Core standards and that also allow states to compare results across states, which some people think is a good thing. So we're going to see some changes on the testing, most likely. I think they're going to give the Senate testing panel came out with kind of an overview of what the written recommendations will be. And they want to give PARC a chance to fix it. Mm-hmm. They want to take two testing periods and combine them into one. They want it closer to the end of the school year. They want the results faster. These things all seem doable, so I think that's probably the sensible middle where we'll end up.
What about all the other tests? Because that seems to be – it was not just the PARC test, but it was like, okay, but it's on top of these other tests that we take, well, these district-wide tests and these – whatever tests these kids are taking.
It does seem like the state's focusing on the PARC test when they have their own tests that they haven't really been addressing as much, like the reading guarantee or the OGT and everything like that. Kathy's right. Teachers are feeling like – right when the school year starts, it's a race to February to get in as much material as possible because the first PARC test happens in February and that covers 75% of everything that they've learned. And then once that's done, it's a race again for the second round of tests. And so the big concern with teachers has been just do one test closer to the end of the year. And when they do these tests, get us the results a lot faster. I think, what did they say, that this year they might get it in December?
Right. So the students, they're going to have moved on. You know, they're mm-hmm. not even going to have these students. But you have to think about what's the purpose of the test. Is the purpose of the test results to help the teacher craft, you know, instruction? Or is the purpose of the test to hold students accountable, determine whether they move on, hold teachers accountable, determine what kind of evaluation they get? And I don't think we've really clearly defined what the purpose of some of these tests are. We're trying to use them for all these different things, and we probably need to figure that out.
Can't we do both? Can't we use it? If the student's doing well, you can say, well, the teacher's doing well.
Sure. We can do it for – we're like the grown-ups. We can do whatever we want.
But you think the PARC test is – or some version of the PARC test is probably here to stay.
I think that Ohio is one of the largest states left in the PARC consortium. And I think the PARC consortium is going to want to please Ohio because they're going to want to keep Ohio as part of that consortium. So, yes, I think PARC people will figure out how to address some of the concerns that Ohio has so that Ohio stays part of the consortium. I think that's the bottom line. We should also bring up that Governor Kasich had a proposal to cut testing by about 20% based on recommendations the state superintendent issued in February. Most of that reduction would come in the lower grades, the assessments that are given to kids in elementary school. Yeah.
And the changes to PARC, there are two factors to think about. There's a certain amount of time. There's a window of time. So they have to do this quickly. If they're going to fix it by next year, they have to make these changes quickly. And what the PARC officials were saying is it's going to cost the state some money to make these changes too. So we're going to have to see what's next as far as that goes.
I got to believe there's other states that are also pressuring for, you know, collapsing and combining tests and not doing as much testing hours.
Yeah, I know New York is. I'm pretty sure New York is the same movement is happening there.
But Ohio does have a lot of clout. It's a big state.
Exactly.
What if the test scores from Park come back great? What if they come back and everyone's really happy with them? Teachers, parents.
That would solve it.
Yeah. I mean, we don't even know what the scores are yet. You know, you know how it is. You took a class and, you know, boy, that chemistry test was hard. And it comes back and you got an A on it. Well, it was pretty good. It's a good test.
Well, the reality, though, is that these new exams that align with Common Core, whether there's the Park exams or AIRs, the other testing company that does the science and social studies, they're all designed to be more rigorous.
Yeah.
So everyone kind of expects the scores to be lower, which isn't going to help the argument because no one's going to be happy about the lower scores. But we'll see. Maybe we'll be surprised.
Change is hard. Speaking of change, charter schools, we have an email from Avery wants to know what the status is of the charter school reform legislation. Is that tied up? That's tied up in the budget, too, because there is some money for charter schools.
There's some stuff tied up in the budget, but there are some standalone bills that are going through the committee process right now.
There's a big bill in the Senate that has a lot of bipartisan support. It's Peggy Lehner's bill. And then there's also a bill in the House that looks like it's got a lot of support. Is it Christina Rogner?
And it's the same legislation.
Well, no, I thought it was more narrow.
I think it's more narrow. I think Lehner's bill is
more comprehensive.
Yeah, it's more comprehensive. And there seems to be a lot of momentum behind this charter school accountability. They want the schools to be held more accountable. They want more transparency, and they want quicker closure of those poor performing schools. And I think they want to put more pressure on the school sponsors to kind of oversee these schools and make sure things are going well.
And also make sure there's that the conflict of interest issues are addressed.
Yes.
So are you talking about HB2? Rogner's first bill was scaled down, but Rogner's presented a second bill now that looks exactly like Peggy Lehner's bill.
Oh, yes, yes. She's the House sponsor of the – yes, you're right.
So even the Republican representative who did want a scaled-down version is now open to the idea. Yeah, so even she's on board with
– yeah, and in the Senate, they had a big press conference recently, and there was Democrats and Republicans. You don't see that a lot, Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all there, everybody.
They were spilling off the stage. There were so many people.
Yeah, there were so many people there.
And that study that came out saying that closing schools isn't as harmful as we all feared or thought it might be, if a poor performing school, that the kids actually do just fine. They adapt and move on and go to a different school.
That's right. And there's been some studies. These have all been commissioned by the Fordham Foundation, which is a big proponent of kind of charter schools, but holding them accountable and kind of closing the bad actors. There's a lot of people in the charter school support camp that feel bad charter schools have given all the charter schools a bad name, and they want to kind of fix that.
Just a couple of minutes left. We can't forget that there is an election tomorrow. Columbus voters are going to narrow the field of mayor from 4 candidates down to 2. It's a nonpartisan primary, so the top 2 vote-getters will move on to November. Odds are that the top 2 vote-getters will be Democrats. So I know you all don't cover city politics, but in the bigger view, if you look at all the cities in Ohio, the major cities in Ohio, it's all Democrats, correct, that are running these cities. Is that a permanent fixture that Democrats will run the cities and Republicans the suburbs?
Well, I think the Ohio Democratic Party certainly looks to the big city mayors and city councils as their farm team for future statewide races. Typically, I think the urban areas are a little bit more Democratic than
– Now, you know, before Mayor Coleman, though, didn't – Columbus had a Republican
mayor.
Yeah,
Greg Lashutka and Buck Reinhardt before
Buck
him.
Buck Reinhardt, that's right. Yeah.
Tom Moody was a Republican, you know. But it's just changed so much for whatever reason.
You know what's cool about this election, just seeing this process play out as reporters who wanted to see a gubernatorial debate, at least one gubernatorial debate, these mayor candidates have done, I think, 4 big debates at least.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really great to see that they're all game to come out and discuss their views and defend their opinions on things.
And it's interesting also, you talk about why all the Democrats in City Hall and in the mayor's office. We just had in Columbus a Democratic state rep, Stinziano, who left to go run for council because he could actually have an impact.
Yeah.
It's tough to be a Democrat in the state house because, you know, you're in the minority. And you've been in the minority for a long time. So I don't know, maybe the folks, you know, are seeing it as more appealing.
Yep, we'll see. Thanks to Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.